Today is March 8, 2019, and my name is Deborah Schwartz, and I am sitting here in the Mill Valley Public Library on behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Public Library with two pivotal individuals, Jeff Davidson and Mike St. John. Now, I welcome, gentlemen.
Good morning.
This is a unique interview for me in that we have, usually I interview one-on-one, but I'm very pleased today to have the both of you together to talk about so many interesting things, so pertinent to so many people here in Mill Valley, and to help the community understand your perspective, too, as firemen, as protectors of the land and of the people of this community, as the individuals that we rely on at sometimes the most difficult times of our life. So I consider this to be a very important interview, and I'm so appreciative, and so is the Historical Society and the library, for the time that you're giving us today. So welcome.
Thank you.
And we're happy to be here.
Good. I would normally introduce people, and I give a long list of... normally, I introduce my interviewees and as author, artist, musician. In introducing you two as firemen, you have such a long list of duties and positions that you've embodied that I would, this time, in this particular interview, would love it if you could introduce yourselves. So let's start with Jeff.
Okay. First off, if I may correct you on one point, fireman is a very old-fashioned term, so firefighter is a more traditional or more modern term because it tends to be a little bit more expansive and inclusive. So
thank
I'll try
you.
To use yes. that term where I can.
Yes, thank so. You. And me too.
Good.
I think you can tell my age by the way that I use my language.
Yeah.
But for all of us, this is very important.
Yes.
And so thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So good morning. My name is Jeff Davidson, and I started my time with the Mill Valley Fire Department in 1979. I had started a few years prior to that in my fire service career in 1976 at the age of 16 through a work experience education program at Drake High School. And I worked 2 days a week for a couple of semesters at the fire department and ultimately became a volunteer with that fire department before coming to Mill Valley in 1979. I was hired in Mill Valley as a cadet firefighter, and during my 35 years with Mill Valley, I held every position that the department had with the exception of a paramedic. So I started as a cadet firefighter and went to a temporary hire firefighter as an underfill, and then went to a full-time position in 1982 as a firefighter. In 1986, I was promoted to fire captain. And then 6 months after that, we had created a new position in the department, which was a fire captain prevention specialist, and I assumed that role. And then in 3 years later, 1989, I was promoted to a battalion chief position. And at the time, we had three battalion chiefs, one on each of the three shifts, and I was assigned as the battalion chief on B shift. And then spent approximately 21 years as a battalion chief before being appointed to the fire chief position in 2011 and held that position for just under 3 years until my retirement in 2014. And also during my time as a shift battalion chief, as in most small departments, you have additional assignments. So for a period of time, I was the department's training and safety officer, and for a large portion of the time, I was the department's fire marshal, and I also was coordinating emergency management programs for the whole city. And then in retirement since 2014, I've maintained my connection to the fire service through being an adjunct faculty at the Santa Rosa Junior College, which I've actually been doing for about 20 to 25 years. Teaching in the Fire Academy and doing program management. I'm also on the North Bay Incident Management Team, which is a four-county team that helps support departments with escalating incidents, and I am one of the plan section chiefs on that team. And I'm also a volunteer fire lookout up on Mount Tamalpais.
Wow. Well, thank you for that. Yeah. I'm glad I didn't have to introduce you. Okay, and you, Mike St. John.
So I moved to Marin County in 1971. I lived in Novato for a time. I lived out in Inverness, which is a small community where I was first exposed to firefighting, where my both of my parents were volunteer firefighters for the Inverness Volunteer Fire Department. We had a fire phone in our house that would ring in the middle of the night, and you know, so it was introduced early on. At that time when I lived in Inverness, I also started in volunteer search and rescue, which I still do to this day. So I became very interested in emergency services. I started my fire service career in 1985 as a seasonal firefighter for the Marin County Fire Department. Only a few months later, I also started the Kentfield Fire Protection District as a resident firefighter, or they call them sleepers. And I remained there for 3 years. And then, you know, when you're in that early phase of your fire service, you're doing everything you can. You know, so I went through the fire academy at that time. I worked for Marin Ambulance, which at the time was a private ambulance company. I worked as an underfill firefighter for the city of Larkspur. And then I got my first break being hired as a trainee firefighter about 5 years after Jeff was hired in Mill Valley in 1987. And then I was hired full-time in 1988. I had a great experience as a firefighter in Mill Valley, and 10 years later, in 1997, I was promoted to captain. And then in 2011, I was promoted to battalion chief. Through much of that time in the early 90s, I started with the Marin County Hazmat Team. And so I responded countywide on hazmat incidents. I only retired about 120 days ago, so I'm still getting used to, you know, the retirement thing. But I will continue to work part-time here and there for the city of Mill Valley, helping with the new vegetation management ordinances. Additionally, I also serve with Jeff on the North Bay Incident Management Team. And then what keeps me busy on my days off is I'm very active statewide. And in teaching and curriculum development on the volunteer search and rescue side, which is under the sheriff's office.
Great. Thank you both for your introductions. Before we progress into the interview with more about the city and firefighting in general, I would love it if you could tell a little bit of contextual information about your families. For example, Jeff, in our pre-interview discussion, you talked about the history of firefighting in your family.
Yeah.
Maybe you could expand on that.
So I am a fifth-generation Marin County resident. My family were settlers in Sausalito, Marin City, Waldo Point, and my aunt's house still stands in Marin City. It's for a period of time was a community center, and it's sort of now shuttered and defunct, but it's still there as one of the last remaining original homes in the Marin City area. And my step-grandfather and my father both served as volunteer or firefighters with the Marin County Fire Department, actually the Marin City Fire Department before it became the Marin County Fire Department. So a long history in Marin County and lineage in the fire service. And similar to Mike's experience early on, having the fire service sort of just ingrained into part of your daily life, we didn't have a fire phone at the house, but our babysitter was the whistle on the roof of the fire station at 5 o'clock, because when we were out playing in the creek or riding our bikes around before mountain biking was a thing, when we heard that whistle at 5 o'clock, we knew it was time to come home. So the fire department always was present in our lives. And, you know, from a very early age, I was interested in firefighting, and just saw the people, you know, as larger than life figures, and was awed by them, not even at a young age knowing exactly what they did, but just seeing them as people that sort of brought calm to chaotic moments. And when I was 8 years old, I was in downtown Fairfax with my dad watching a bike race. And we were talking to one of the firefighters at the station. And as we were talking, the 10-speed bikes were just flying by. And I leaned out to look at one of the bikes as it went by. And all of a sudden, there was a hand on my shoulder. And I got pulled back just as a bike went flying by. And it was the firefighter who just saw it coming and intervened and made a moment of, how do I say it? it was a moment in my life that could have gone differently had someone not been there. And I'm like, well, I want to do what that guy does.
Yeah, I think that moment of, aha, I think this is what they do.
That's cool. Yeah, so very early on, I knew what I wanted to do. And I was also at that young age range, and Mike might have been on the tail end of this, but in the late 70s, early 80s, I can't remember exactly the time frame, but the TV show Emergency was hugely instrumental in a lot of people of my age because it introduced, you know, the world to firefighting and paramedicine, and it actually influenced the profession and the service we provide beyond just getting people interested in the job. And perhaps we can talk about that a little bit more, too. So.
The names of your relatives, if you would share them, please. Your father, your grandfather, sure. Your step-grandfather.
Yeah, my father is Bob Davidson. He's 94 years old. He lives in Novato, and he was born and raised in Sausalito, Marin City area. And just prior to his service during World War II and right after when he was discharged from service in the Army, he was a firefighter with the Marin City and then Marin County Fire Department. And his stepfather, Arthur Ebrich, I think was a stonemason. I can't remember exactly, but he was a volunteer firefighter, like many people in the communities, you know, before the communities were even organized, were engaged socially through things like volunteer firefighting. And in fact, the Mill Valley Volunteer Firefighters were an organization formed in 1893, and the city of Mill Valley wasn't even incorporated until 1901. So the volunteer firefighters were formed up and organized before the city was even an entity.
Mm-hmm. And then you have another grandfather, too?
No, just the father and the step-grandfather.
And you were born what year?
I was born in 1960 in Larkspur at, I think it was called the Cottage Hospital, but it was Marin General Hospital, and I spent my whole life in Marin County.
And your mother's name?
Dorothy.
And any siblings?
I have four brothers. One passed away in 1993, and he was 33 when he passed away. And my other brothers were all married and living our lives here in Marin County. We're all still...
Oh, any firefighters?
County. No. No. Contractors, CFO, and I'm the government employee in the family.
And so we don't forget them, their names, please.
My oldest brother is Larry, and my second oldest brother is Ken. My brother who passed away is Tim, and then my younger brother is Mike. And we were all 3 years apart, except my younger brother and I, who are 4 years apart.
Okay, great.
And then I'm talking about my wife, too. Get that in now? Or,
okay. I think that's a good idea.
Sure.
Yes.
So I've been married for, I think, 31 years, if I did the math correctly. My wife's name is Leona George Davidson now. And she was born in Brooklyn and came to Marin County, I think, at 16 or 17. And when I first met her, her mom was the owner of the Old Mill Bakery on Miller Avenue.
Oh, yes.
So if you...
Yes.
Yeah. If you met my wife, she'd probably go, oh, cheese Danish and a coffee. She remembers
German
a lot
bread.
Of the old timers by what the order was. Yes. So she was involved at the time with the Chamber of Commerce, and we connected up through a fire department event and the Chamber of Commerce merging together, and we've been together for 31 years and no kids. We decided that we didn't want to have kids, but she needed kids in her life. So we formed a nonprofit about 20 years ago, and we do service work in Mexico. And she gets her kid fixed by working with youth, by bringing them to Mexico for house building work or working with the youth in Mexico.
Great. Thank you so much. And, and how about you, Michael? Cal, can you share a little bit about your history and your family's history?
Yeah. So we came to Marin County, and I didn't have a lot of immediate family that surrounded our family. I have two younger brothers and a younger sister.
Their names?
So I have my next youngest brother is Daniel, mm-hmm. and he lives here in Mill Valley. I have a brother, Douglas, that lives in San Francisco, and my sister, Sarah, who's married to a retired firefighter, just recently moved up near Bend, Oregon. And then my mom actually lives here in the community at the Redwoods.
Her name?
Barbara. And then my father, Charles, lives near in Pinerolo, Italy, with his wife there. So we started in Novato, and then my parents wanted to have a more rural lifestyle, so we moved out to Inverness. We had an amazing place. It's now bed and breakfast in Inverness, and that's where I spent a lot of the formative years. I did some stuff that might be considered a little bit outside the box, where I did vaulting, which is gymnastics on the back of a cantering horse, being lunged in a circle, and where you get up to three people doing acrobatic exercises on a horse. So I did that for 7 years and competed in Europe.
Did you train in Inverness for that?
Point Reyes Station actually had the vaulting club. And then later I was with the Nicosia Vaulting Club. And that was an amazing experience. And then once I graduated high school, I actually struggled in college a little bit with direction and whatnot. And then one day really became focused on pursuing a fire service career. I'd worked in the printing industry for a couple years, running printing presses, doing bindery and customer service. But I realized that was my dad's life, and I didn't want to do what he had done. I wanted to do something that was closer to my heart. And I really enjoyed, you know, my search and rescue experience up into that time and what we got to do. So that's what kind of pushed me into the fire service. And I really love firefighting. I was married in 1993, had a child by the name of Aaron, who's 21 now. That relationship ended, and I've been with my current wife, Holly, for the last 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
And she works in Oakland for the University of California.
Mm-hmm. And you were born, did you tell me what year you were born?
I was born in 1963.
Okay, great. Good. I think that helps us get a little bit a better idea of who you were before you became the men that you are today. So let's jump into the firefighting, shall we? What would be great in this interview, I think, is to be able to capture over time the evolution of your careers and also firefighting itself and how it's changed, how it was, how it's changed, and where you'd like it to go in the future. And the whole dynamic between your experiences learned, earned, wisdom gained, lessons learned the hard way, and the ways that what I'd really like to be able to discuss at some point here is the ways that the community can support the fire department in a way that everybody benefits. So where would you like to begin in this complicated and very meaty discussion?
Yeah. It was interesting in the early stages of the fire department, and you don't notice it at the moment, but when you reflect back, at some levels, it was a bit of the Wild Wild West mixed with the Keystone Cops, because it was very much just throw a lot of stuff at a problem, and the problem usually went away, and the problems were... they presented themselves as being a little bit more straightforward, but in retrospect, they were just as much and just as problematic as they are nowadays. We just didn't recognize from a health and safety standpoint the things that we did to attack fires. So, you know, as an example, we wouldn't have the same level of safety equipment that we have now, or we wouldn't have the level of organization or command and control. So it would be sort of ants on a hill, you know, to put a fire out. And nowadays it's much more structured and organized, and it's still chaotic, but it's controlled chaos, and it's designed, you know, to provide the quickest response, but keeping the firefighters as safe as possible, because we recognize now the long-term health effects of the exposures to chemicals or to you know, the injuries that we can, you know, put ourselves in by not being organized, not being thoughtful, not having the appropriate safety equipment. And, you know, the second or third fire ever went on, I got burnt because we didn't have the kind of facial protection that you have now. So it was a very common thing back in the day, you know, to tell how hot it was by, you know, whether your ears were getting singed or if the tip of your nose was getting hot. And we didn't wear the pants that we wear now. We just wore regular Ben Davis black or Levi's. And so the evolution of the equipment has, you know, given us a better level of protection. The training and education that we have gone through and continue to go through has made us a much more smarter firefighting force. And I've looked back on some of the early fires that I went to in my career and thought, boy, if I was in charge of that now, I would, you know, be answering before the man, if you will, for why did you put them in that circumstance and why did you make that decision? And a lot of times there wasn't a lot of good thought behind the decisions. You saw a problem and you just threw a lot of people at it.
It's a science, really, isn't it, firefighting, as it evolves and you've got more technology and more understanding.
Well, in the old days, I would say it was very blue collar. It was just, you know, you saw a problem, you just got a bigger lever. And now it's very much a white collar lifestyle. You have to have a head to be able to think, to educate, to train, to impart information. But when the bell rings, it becomes very blue collar. But you have to then not just revert back to knuckle dragging, if you will, but you put the science and the training together and do it smarter, not harder. So it's a combination of, you know, two skills. And there's very few jobs that are out there nowadays that are not just one or the other. And ours is that combination of both. And you have to, you know, be able to live in both worlds. And it has to be able to happen at a moment's notice.
Mike?
So when I came into the fire service, there had already been a significant transition before I came, and it was still in a massive transition. People that I ultimately started working with came into the fire service 15 or 20 years prior to me, and very few had any college education. The vast majority came up as volunteers, and it wasn't back in the 70s and early 80s as competitive to get a job. When I started taking fire tests in 1987, 88, 89, actually 87, 88, you would have between 50 to 300 people applying for one or two jobs. And it was very intimidating to go to a fire test and look at all these incredibly capable people that were super eager to get a job. And that was kind of a recent shift. And so it was intimidating to continue to go to test after test. And I ultimately, you know, took 14 tests before I landed here in Mill Valley across California. When I got into the fire service, they had just started to wear bunker pants. And this is about probably 7 years after Jeff came in. There was more emphasis on safety equipment. There was more emphasis on prevention. And but you still had a lot of the old school blue collar firefighters that had a very old approach to doing things. And from the time that I started, which is before there were computers in the fire station, to the time that I ended, a huge amount of stuff was thrown on our plate, you know, and we can come back to that, to that later. But it was, definitely the training back then was very basic.
Give an example when you say very basic.
So, compared to where we are today, you know, back in that time, if you went out and did a few hose lays, did a SCBA drill.
People listening won't know what that means.
That's a practice of putting on your self-contained breathing apparatus.
Mm-hmm. The tank that you wear on your back with the mask
in front, yes.
Exactly. Throwing a ladder. Those were skills that are still today foundational in the fire service, but that was really all we focused on. And we didn't do it in a scenario-based setting. You know, we didn't keep times as much. We didn't make it in a realistic training environment. And so I think the passion, a lot of the, we had some outstanding firefighters, and I want to be clear about that. But certainly today, most of the applicants that I saw in the last 5 years, I would say 3/4 of them had college degrees. Many of them had bachelor's degrees. The sophistication that they have to go into today with technology, the realism of training, you know, all of that's dramatically evolved over the last 30 years since I've come in.
Yeah. And if I may, so when I started, the criteria to get hired was that you drove a dump truck on your day off so you knew how to drive a fire truck. And the badges were all numbered. So when you got hired, if there was 10 firefighters in the department, you were the new guy, you got badge number 10. And then somebody above you retired and the badges moved up. And then when you became firefighter, well, actually back then it was fireman number one, you were going to get the next captain's job. And it was all just seniority based, and it was not merit based, and it wasn't a balance of education and you know, performance. Nowadays, a firefighter comes in and has multiple task books that they have assigned to them. You have to get checked off on the ambulance. You have to get checked off on driving the ambulance. You have to get checked off on driving the ambulance at night. You have to get checked off on operating the equipment in the back of the ambulance. So there's check-offs all along the way to validate and certify the work that you're doing. And so it's become much more comprehensive and much more realistic and, like Mike said, scenario-based. You know, we would bring a new firefighter on in Mill Valley in 1980, and you'd take them out back once and make sure they could raise and lower the ladder, and then you never went to the ladder again unless there was a call.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just train when you have to, but the training came when you had a fire call.
Yes, the training. You know, I was a volunteer fire person in 1979, and I recall well that the drills, or really not so much drills, but you just went out. You learned on the job, and and everybody helped each other. Well, those that were willing to help. Some, it seemed to me that there was prove yourself attitude going on too, and that's part of the training as well. But now you're describing something that's more systematical. That's more with the like the checklist before a pilot takes off, where nothing can be missed, and trying to avoid the hard way, because we are talking about people's lives here and the integrity of structures and the town.
And the people's lives that you're going to protect, but also your lives that you need to rely on each other so you can perform as a team to serve your community.
Yeah, so when you talk about the slow evolution of change, were there pivotal events that propelled the change at a greater speed than would have naturally happened over time? For example, in earthquake safety, for each new large earthquake offers many opportunities to protect in the next. Is this how your technology changed, or was it a gradual? I mean, how did it proceed?
Sure. So the way I would back up and describe that, when I came in at the end of the 70s into the 80s, it was the influence of the TV show Emergency that everybody just expected that the fire department showed up to any kind or type of call, and any compartment door you opened, you had the piece of equipment needed, and it was primarily around the paramedics. So paramedicine became huge in the 1980s, where fire departments sometimes didn't even respond on medical calls. It became a primary mission. Then in the 90s, hazardous materials became the new thing, and we all geared up and started doing entry-level awareness, which became operational, which became specialist, which became specialized county equipment.
So you're talking about hazmat materials. Can you unpack that a little bit for people that don't know much about
firefighting? So we're talking about anything from a gasoline truck driving through town with gasoline that's topping off your gas stations to a rail car along the side of the freeway to a natural gas line explosion or rupture, hazardous chemicals, which we now realize are on the shelves of every grocery store and packed in every house because of the cleaners and the solvents and the chemicals. And we learned that, you know, just throwing a firefighting approach to solving those problems could sometimes make them worse. So the 90s were very big in our gearing up towards the awareness of and the response to that. And then in the 2000s, you know, and probably as a direct result of September 11th was, you know, the terrorism and weapons of mass destruction. And now into the 2010 decade, I would say active shooter and, you know, sort of homegrown terrorism. So with each decade, we add to the toolbox of tools that we have to carry. But then going back to your question about earthquakes, the fire department has historically and traditionally been seen of as an operational, responsive organization. The problems happen, go out and stop it. What we also started to do during that time was realize that we needed to get more aggressive with preventing or minimizing impacts through working collaboratively on building codes for earthquakes or working with the planning department so that homes weren't built without driveways or that homes built in a wooded area were less susceptible to the effects of a wildland fire, so that we became more of a preventative and mitigating arm rather than just a responsive arm. Because when the problem occurs, they call us and then they ask us, how did it get this bad? And, you know, we are now able to say, well, we're going to respond to this, but we need help designing it better on the front end. And that's where this collaboration comes in with our community partners, other departments within a city or a county, neighborhood organizations, because then it comes down to that individual preparedness. And we can only respond at a certain level without people taking that, you know, step to help us. We're behind the curve because we're being called after the problem's already happened.
When you talk about the community organizations, let's get some names.
Sure.
Okay.
So Mill Valley has been at ground zero for community preparedness since the 90s, 2000s. It started out as a couple of people that were involved in what was called the NERT program in San Francisco, Neighborhood Emergency Response Training, which came out of the Loma Prieta and the Northridge earthquake. There was a lady named Meryl Good, who still lives in town, and you should interview her. She was banging on our door about, we got to get this NERT program going, and we got to get this going. And then Skip Gosser, Susan Ferris, Susan Moxon, very early on, people that were not taking no for an answer. And the city was smart enough to realize that there was a community interest, and at the same time, we had the Oakland Hills fire, and so the city organized a fire safety task force, and one of the recommendations that came out of that was more community engagement, and out of that came the Emergency Preparedness Committee, which is now a permanent Emergency Preparedness Commission, and their initiative was to organize and educate and support the efforts to get the word out, and to our great luck and benefit, we have Mike St. John in the fire department at the time, who had a parallel life organizing volunteers in search and rescue and knew what it was like to work with volunteers and to bring people with different interests together. And he created what is the model countywide and in some cases around the state for how to organize neighborhoods and communities around disaster preparedness, and I'll let him chime in on some of that.
I look to you now, Mike. Are we talking CERT here?
Yes. Yeah, so you want to cover CERT now?
Proceed as you wish. All right. Let's. If you want to talk about other things first and then go to CERT, that's great too.
So I think it's important to understand that in the early 1970s, Mill Valley Fire Department, when they had a significant incident, it was a badge of honor not to have to call for help. And so the mutual aid agreements and the collaborative nature of the fire service today was very different back then. And it evolved quickly, I would say, you know, from the mid to late 1970s moving forward, where mutual aid became more active.
And that wasn't just Mill Valley's badge of honor. Every fire department respected boundaries, and you didn't go to a neighbor's fire unless you were asked. So it was a much different world back then.
And so on a national level, the fire service has evolved. And I think that was probably the biggest influencing factor to the professionalization of the fire service, the focus on better training. And certainly in the late 90s and early 2000s, we were influenced by agencies around us to train harder, to become more capable. In addition to that, we became more and more aware of not only the challenges we faced on the wildland-urban interface, but also the challenges we face on having, you know, almost a third or half of our community as hillside homes, which pose unique challenges. So, you know, a lot of that kind of fed off each other, and people started going more and more to national conferences. Firefighters began going to more and more national conferences, and throughout the county, collaboration on a training level, which Jeff really played a big role in, from multi-agency drills that were countywide or even regional exercises.
When you say multi-agency, we're talking all within the fire department here.
Yes.
There's no outside agencies you're collaborating with yet.
No.
We involved law enforcement partners in our early mutual aid exercises.
Okay. Yeah.
But when primarily firefighting driven.
Primarily firefighting driven. Mm-hmm. But when I say multi-agency drill, there could be 15 or 20 agencies from across Marin and Sonoma all training together.
So these are all the different departments
starting to really work closely together.
Yes.
And that really took off, I would say, in the 90s, probably post the Oakland firestorm. You know, we realized that these significant fire incidents were nearby. And then in 1995, we had the Vision Fire, mm-hmm. which, you know, was an all hands.
And this is the event. Fire that in Point Reyes.
Right.
So basically what you're describing is that attitude of being self-sufficient really wasn't going to be as helpful as working with other departments and collaborating as a whole together to help each other.
Right. And you have to understand when you're facilitating a training program, which takes a lot of everything from curriculum building to having subject matter experts, it's a lot easier if you can rely on your surrounding agencies to help facilitate that stuff. You can put together oftentimes a better training by involving more people. It's actually left at less effort because you're sharing that. So a lot of that started to occur, you know, probably beginning in the late 80s, but really took off in the 90s and 2000s, where today, Marin, even though we're a number of different agencies, you know, we routinely across the county share in significant training exercises, you know, stuff that was unheard of really, you know, back in before the, you know, early 1980s.
And of course, this is facilitated by the ability to communicate through the internet.
Right.
It helps.
Yes.
What helped prior to that, though, was, as Mike said, you know, when we start going to conferences and getting formal education, I was one of those younger ones coming up, and, you know, you go away to a training program and then you come back and then, oh, well, then you get to be in charge of putting something together. And I realized that my neighbor across the way in a different fire department was at the same class with me. So we would get together and collaborate sort of on the sidelines, if you will, and then we'd start to share. Then pretty soon the manuals all start to look the same. Then instead of you doing training and me doing it the next day with the same instructor, we'd bring one instructor in and kind of come to a border area because we couldn't leave our own towns. But we slowly over time just opened up the sieve a little bit. So more and more of that cooperation filtered through.
It's funny to hear you talk. I can imagine in my mind the tender capillaries that are going out and then connecting and then becoming larger capillaries and then veins and arteries and all the ways it strengthens in a really natural fashion.
Very much so. And it's not uncommon for a battalion chief like Mike in Mill Valley to be in charge of his incident in Mill Valley, but the next day could be going up and reporting to a captain in Novato on a hazmat call. Doesn't matter about rank, it doesn't matter about borders, it's your capabilities and your skills are brought to bear on a problem and you blend in very naturally together. There isn't barriers in between those things anymore.
Was there resistance initially when that individualist attitude of we take care of ourselves, we're, you know, almost a macho attitude really, that ownership of space and this is where we take care of each other. Was there kickback when that started to, with the old school? When that started to change?
When I was first in the fire prevention assignment, I wanted to get a computer-based program to help manage the inspections. And my boss was dead set against it. And he, you know, I've got the Rolodex on my desk. And I, you know, why do I need this fancy computer thing? And I said, look, I'm going to get you the first computer and you're going to, you know. And I went and I bought one of those display computers that's on the desk at Office Depot. It was just a cardboard cutout and I put it on his desk. And it was my way of saying, you know.
This is happening, people.
Yeah. So there was definitely resistance to change. And there always is. And that's, you know, inevitable. And that's human nature. But the fire service is not immune to that. And even an old guy like me, when Mike would come back from a class and go, hey, I just went to this class. You know.
Here we go again.
Here we go again.
But back to you, Mike, and the training, CERT and other, you know, the ways that you were starting to engage the community in a more active way. Because let's just say this flat out. One of the biggest concerns that we have here in Mill Valley and Marin County, because we have all this natural beauty, but we are so vulnerable to fire. And we live on a transformed fault margin. These are some of the most active fault margins in the world. So we don't have hurricanes necessarily. We may not have be pelted by lightning strikes, but everybody that lives here is worried about natural disasters. Some more seasonal, although that seems to be changing. You know, for many people that live in Mill Valley, September, October can be a very mm-hmm. tense time. Things are dry, and we're worried about fires more than ever now with how things have changed. But other, you know, if there's an earthquake, there could be a fire sparked from that. And we've got landslides. We have El Nino, El Nina. We have variation in our weather patterns. All these things render us vulnerable. So, but in particular, I have to say, I mean, living here, that fires a yearly and now monthly concern. So CERT and having community involvement, I imagine, I'd like to know, actually, I'm not going to presume, but do you have more? I mean, I remember when CERT started and you had the community or the neighborhoods had their own neighborhood meetings, and then we had the fire department come and talk to us, evacuation routes, preparation, and so on. Would you address that whole aspect of your experience?
So I was pursuing a promotion to captain in 1997. And up until that time, CERT was separate from the fire department. We would come in and occasionally help teach the courses, but it was largely community driven. And it was largely out of the brand new Emergency Preparedness Commission that was pushing that. And what I saw after 2 or 3 years of training, they probably started around 1994, 95, is that we had 30 or 40 CERT, maybe even probably closer to 100 CERT volunteers at that time, that there was no plan to utilize them. There was no structure to utilize them. And so I took the experience that I had gained managing a volunteer search and rescue team, where I had about 70 or 80 volunteers that were actually a fairly active program. And how can we kind of make them volunteer firefighters in a way? And that if there is a major disaster or significant incident, we would pull them in. But if we're going to do that, then we should put together, you know, training once or twice a year, make it a light touch, but something where people feel like they belong to an organization. So we're not spending all this time training people and then we never see them again. At this time, Mill Valley had put a ton of work into organizing neighborhoods, which had been the primary focus of the Emergency Preparedness Commission. And so as part of my captain's test, doing something new and innovative that I really never thought I was going to have to carry out, I put together a proposal of how you could organize your CERT volunteers as part of the project. To promote to captain at that time, and even today, you go through what's called an assessment center, which is a multi-discipline test that includes written evaluation of personnel issues, an oral board, and a tactics dimension. And so once you go through, and part of that was writing a report of what you do to improve the city. So I got promoted. and never thought about it again. And a few weeks later, Jeff called me into the office and said, hey, I've been talking to the public safety director, and we want you to proceed with this project.
And CERT is an acronym for?
Community Emergency Response Team.
Okay.
Or training if you don't have teams organized
right.
in the community.
Including radio training. I think I took a...
Yeah, some radio training in that. And so with that, I had the list of people that had been through CERT training, and I just started cold calling people until I had a nexus of about six or seven, and we had our first meeting. And then through that, delegated assignments, and we were actually, Mill Valley is made up of a whole bunch of people that are super dedicated to their community. And it was an area that really appealed to a number of people to get involved. And so we did our first advanced CERT training is what we called it. And I was very surprised we had 45 people show up.
And who were the, do you remember the names of the first few you worked with?
Yes, Stephen Podesta, Maggie Lane, a little later, Stephanie Moulton Peters, who later became a city council member. In fact, we've had a number of people go through CERT that later evolved into emergency preparedness. Pierre Grauman.
Skip Gosser.
Skip Gosser. A number of people stepped up to be a part of that.
Okay. So you now you're working here. You're strengthening and collaborating beyond the confines of Mill Valley. You're evolving as firefighters in your technology and your ability to understand the actual science of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got community support at this time.
Yeah, and then the other thing that I think that helped us really evolve and become more cohesive is when a person worked in Mill Valley in the 1970s and probably up to the mid-80s, you stayed in Mill Valley. You rarely left Mill Valley. But the mutual aid system in California started to be exercised more and more. And so by the early 90s, and it's continued to expand to this day, it's not uncommon for engine company or firefighters to be out for a couple weeks at a time fighting fires throughout California. And so through this experience, it really kind of opened up in the late 80s and the early 2000s. You got to see a lot of significant incidents, get a lot of experience, and also work with firefighters from across the state or sometimes across the country. So I think that also, began our evolution and also awareness of the challenges we face back here in Mill Valley.
Yes, of course, because now you're working in a different environment. And preparing for all the day. So it's just really, well, that's fantastic. Very mm-hmm. interesting.
I want to add a piece in here that has always been important for me. And yes, you're correct when you say we had community support. But we had 100% of support of about 6% of the community.
Yeah.
And when you say Mill Valley's citizens, their biggest concerns are, I would say the challenge to that is when we hold public meetings or we put information out, we get the same 30 people at the meeting. And so there's a lot of people that aren't aware of the threat, should be aware of the threat. And if they are, they want someone else to solve the problem. So for me, as a chief at the 30,000 foot level, my biggest tactical challenge was trying to get the community to acknowledge the problems that existed. And how do you do that without scaring them to the point where they just put their head in the sand or just turn it right around and say, well, your government, you solve my problem for me. But a big problem is just awareness in not just Mill Valley, but in most of the communities that are in California nowadays. People just don't seem to understand that an earthquake can happen at any moment, or that when it rains, power could go out, or that if there's a hot, dry day in the summer and there's a power line that goes down, it could be the significant catastrophic fire. So for me, one of the biggest threats is lack of awareness.
Yeah, lack of personal preparedness, lack of personal responsibility, that you're responsible to take care of yourself and your family. And any given day, if I queried a bunch of people, brought a bunch of people together in Mill Valley or other communities and asked how many were truly ready to take care of themselves for 3 or 4 days after a major earthquake, you know, the average response of people is about 30% of the room. Mm-hmm. You know, at most is really ready for that.
Yep. And then when you drill down into that, I guess I don't really have as much as I thought I had, or, you know.
Yes.
So I think when you we think about what our threat is as community members, and but it's not so easy to go a little wider in the examination of how we're threatened by you not being able to do what you want to be able to do, and how important it is that the community support you to help us and to do our part as a community to help educate ourselves and others. One of the reasons why we're sitting here in the library today is actually to have this discussion, and it's important to the Historical Society and me personally to do our part to educate. There's a lot of things have changed in Mill Valley in the demographic of those coming in, and we don't have as many firefighters able to actually live in this town or even nearby because of the cost of living now and the cost of real estate, which is a problem for our community, because it's always nice to have first responders right there. As you described earlier on, when you were firefighting in the early years, everybody stayed close to home. Mm-hmm. So this is an issue now, a pertinent issue for right now, as to what we can do, because especially as we have a lot of people coming in, perhaps from other states, perhaps they're too busy in the world to even understand the geology and the biology of this area. They can certainly appreciate how beautiful it is, but there's a price to be paid for living in an area like that. So how have you been dealing with this issue? How do you try to engage the community? And not only that, what can the community do to help you do better in your efforts?
So I'll take the first part of that. I think it's important for people to understand that we as firefighters across California, and there's no debate about this, are seeing longer, warmer, and drier fire seasons. And in 2017, despite having a significant rain, probably one of the wettest years in California, by July, we're seeing fires such as a Detweiler fire burn faster and larger than fires during a drought year. So having a wet winter, which traditionally meant that we weren't going to have a very active fire season, has changed because it warms up more in spring, gets drier quicker. And we're also seeing the magnitude of fires that we've kind of always a little bit been seeing in Southern California, such, you know, migrate north. And so the Car Fire, the Camp Fire that burned 9 out of 10 homes in Paradise, and I can name, you know, a half a dozen others that have involved significant structure loss or threatened entire cities, is much more common. And so the level of responsibility or personal responsibility people have to take today is even greater than it was then. Not just for firefighting, but I also think for earthquakes. The reality is Mill Valley has a community of 14,000 people, plus or minus, and there's only 8 firefighters on duty and 3 police officers. For a community that's placed in several large canyons with narrow streets and difficult access, you know, our utility infrastructure is very vulnerable during significant storms. And we also have communities like the Redwoods that have over 300 people that are high needs, that are or in 7 schools that may end up being the focus of initial response efforts, you know, because that's where the greatest number of people are. And during major storms, particularly after an earthquake or wildland fire, we've always had challenges of gaining access just due to the nature of our community, which is what makes it desirable to live here. But also the shadow side of that is it makes it a challenge to provide, you know, emergency services. So there's going to be new ordinance changes coming out to even push vegetation management back to a new level. because we're really trying to prevent, you know, a fire disaster. And Mill Valley's lived under the cloud of the 1929 fire for years. Certainly that could happen again. But that's not the only significant fire in Mill Valley. Historically, you know, going back to the early 1900s and late 1800s, there was a number of significant fires. So it's part of our history. We've done a good job of suppressing it. But if you look at Mount Tam today, there is never, and this is a quote from Jim Selfridge, who's a battalion chief, and he's done a lot of research, but Mount Tam has never looked the way it does today in its history, because it used to burn every 5 to 7 years. And now we have an accumulation of vegetation that's easily, you know, 70 years old, that's taller and has more dead content material in it than it ever has. So the threat's real.
Yes, in studying the natural environment here, I think I read that 75% of the natural biology of this state proliferates with fire. Mm-hmm. The California itself, and Bay Area as well, in long history, has had fires as frequently as every 25 to 50 years, which clears the undergrowth, yep. Which allows for proliferation of certain kinds of grasses and plants and sod grass type grasses, which are now gone. And so we have a very different environment. When I was studying the history or the health of Mount Tam, they were talking about the drought being two kinds of drought, the green drought and the blue drought. The blue drought, the water that humans worry about consuming, and the green drought, the amount of moisture within the plants themselves. And that they each was a very serious factor when you're looking at how to manage a mountain and its health and its safety. And when I was interviewing Otis Skye, a firefighter, a couple of weeks ago, he was talking about the recent fires that he's watched where he saw trees explode into flame without contact to actual flame itself or embers. Literally, the heat was so great that it was terrifying, and that he worried that there wasn't any real science or would be able to be able to battle that kind of fire other than mm-hmm. run for safety and protect human beings. Mm-hmm. Is this, would you agree with this?
So I had the opportunity this summer and last, but most recently serve as a division group supervisor, working over multiple shifts to save the city of Lakeport. And in traditional times, you know, 5, 10, 15 years ago, you would have a several wide dozer blade wide break. You would reinforce it with hose lays, and you would have aircraft prep it and fire equipment, and you would generally stop the fire, I'm going to say, 7 out of 10 days. And on the most recent fires during the River Fire, the Mendocino Complex, and a number of other fires, the Car Fire, none of that worked. The fire would roll over your fire breaks 9 out of 10 days. And so I would say that the dryness of the fuel, the changing climate, we were not able to stop the spread of the fires until really it burned around communities and we could stop it there.
Or the weather shifted.
Which is what saved the town in 1929.
Right. But I think that was a better day, period of time to be fighting that fire.
Mm-hmm. It wouldn't necessarily stop the fire today if it was the
so,
same.
Yeah, it's very concerning. You know, a lot of the traditional tactics and strategies that we're utilizing aren't working. And so we're adapting. You know, we have what we call VLATs, which is a term called very large air tanker. And so we're switching to much larger firefighting aircraft, Type 1 helicopters, which are the largest helicopters that can drop the largest amount of water, are much more in demand than they used to be, just because that volume is really the only thing, you know, on a good day that makes a difference.
And all of that goes back to the problem's already happened. How do we try to attack it? Mm-hmm. And then that kind of gets back to the question you asked about changing attitudes, or how do you, you know, get inroads in the community. And we were doing CERT classes, the preparedness courses, and the adults are so busy that they don't have time to do it, or you get the same 20 coming to it. So someone got the idea, and I think it's ingenious, to introduce a scale-back version of the Get Ready program to the fifth grade. And that requires the kids to have a take-home homework assignment that they have to do with the parents. It's the beginning of a generational change. And we're ingraining early on in those kids the idea of preparedness and resiliency. And if we have 100 kids go through Get Ready fifth grade tomorrow and we have a problem the next day, we may not have moved the needle much. But year after year, as more kids go through that fifth grade program, which has now been adopted, I think, Bay Area wide, as a model taken out of Mill Valley, you create a generational change. When I started in Mill Valley in 79, fire sprinklers in buildings were only required in commercial buildings over a certain size if it was brand new. I retired 35 years later, and 18% of our community, including residential buildings, have fire sprinklers in them. And it's not uncommon now to go to a fire in a residence that the fire is put out by the sprinkler system. That's 35 years to only get to 18%, but it's those things that you have to do to pre-engineer and build in the ability to mitigate or reduce the impacts so that we don't have to buy bigger airplanes and buy more helicopters and buy more toys and tools, because you still have to have them in the right place at the right time when the fire occurs. And we could have 500 engines parked here in Marin County and still lose homes. Mm-hmm. And it's just once the fire starts, you're behind the curve. So, you know, CERT, yeah. EPC, Emergency Preparedness Commission, the Get Ready programs, trying to make generational changes. And then, you know, going back to our community, it was very blue collar back in the 70s. People have moved out. A lot of people that are now living here are white-collar professionals, higher education, they telecommute or they travel a lot. So they may not have the same level of ability to invest or commit. So let's hit the kids.
They may have a very robust sense of entitlement that this should be handed to them as well.
Well, and they're always, you know, after a big fire or an earthquake occurs, the meetings are packed and the window is wide open. What should we do? And then you put, you know, the same initiative out and they're like, oh my gosh, this is wonderful. Well, you know, why didn't we think about this? And then the next day, the next news cycle, that window starts to close. Right. And people are very interested in what can we do after the Paradise Fire. But now that it's pouring rain out and there's mudslides, people are going to be resistive to being told to cut their brush. Because now they're going to say, well, wait a minute, if I cut my brush because of the fire problem, then the mud's going to take my house out. So we're constantly having to fight the battle of apathy and awareness.
When after the Sonoma fires, I was talking to a gentleman who was actually works for cable company, Comcast or something. And, you know, I'm a hiking guide and I hike with a lot of people and I hear a lot of stories. And he was talking about some of the anecdotes about the fire. And he works with firefighters in the area, and he was, you know, he was describing the reality of what the fire, how, when you're doing triage as a firefighter, choosing which house you can fight for and which you can save. And this gentleman told me when the firefighters saw a defensible home, someone who had put the effort into making their house defensible, they were very inspired to help that individual versus somebody who didn't make those efforts. And I thought that was really putting it quite politely, and also putting it the onus on the homeowner. Show how much you care, because no firefighter wants to give up their life for somebody, you know, it's not so easy to give up your life for somebody who didn't take precautions, you know, but you can fight for those that are helping you fight. I think it's just psychologically, it's got to matter.
Well, we have a phrase or a saying, risk a lot to save a lot, risk a little to save a little. And we're going to, you know, size up a problem and we're going to make a decision as to whether we go inside a building that we know is abandoned and there's nobody in there and it's already so well involved in fire that all we're doing is putting ourselves at risk. And ultimately, it's better to contain it while it burns down because it's going to be easier to bulldoze and rebuild. Same thing in the wildland environment. We're going to be triaging homes. And if someone has taken the effort, it also tells the firefighters that if I get overrun and my access gets cut off, I can have a safe refuge in this home or in this driveway. So it's a two-way street. It's, you know, they've done the work to give you that option of protecting their home, but it also tells the firefighter that if it gets bad and I can't get out of here, this is a place that I can take refuge. And so it very much is part of the thinking that firefighters go into. And I would, you know, stand before the city council or the planning commission on a development of someone who didn't want to put in a driveway or didn't want to pave their driveway, or they didn't want the driveway to be too wide because it would, you know, destroy the chi of the neighborhood. And I would get the question like, well, you guys know this address, and just take the small truck if there's a fire there, or just, you know, just put a note on there that, you know, this driveway is problematic. And I said, I have to plan for an engine from LA County being at the end of this road and making a decision about this driveway, or from Alameda County, or from Tiburon, because when it's all hands on deck, you never know which fire department is going to be there. And yes, we know our community. Yes, we know the nuances, but out of fairness to anyone who's going to come and lend a hand, I want to give them all a fighting chance, including the resident who needs to be able to get in and out of there every single day and get out in an emergency.
And I'll expand on what Jeff said. Never in a million years did I imagine, if I got on a radio and requested additional engines, that they were going to be far away. And I was one of the initial strike teams rolling into Sonoma County during the beginning of the siege. And we got there and we quickly realized that there's a few local volunteer engines and us for probably several miles of open fire line threatening the town of Sonoma and a lot of the communities around it. And so we worked through that day over the next night. And when you put in a request for engines, you know, they said there's nothing there. We don't have any to send you. And you have to understand that whenever there's a fire siege, and this is historically, it's not just the one community, but those fires pop up, you know, in the case of the Sonoma fire siege, they had fires in Butte County, Nevada County, Mendocino County, plus multiple fires in Sonoma County, and
Lake
County.
These aren't seeded fires from the first fire. These are simultaneously
Are just simultaneous events, and it's always based on wind, and typically an east wind with low humidities that drive this. And so there's just complete lack of resources. And during the Sonoma fire siege, our strike team operated for 4.5 days without relief, you know, taking 2 or 3 hour naps here and there, moving around, doing the best we could. So when you looked at triaging structures, it was, what can we put the least effort into to save the most homes? And so defensible space, and more importantly, survivable space, which are homes that have such good defensible space, we don't have to put an engine there, really became key. And so what we did, particularly in the Sonoma and Napa County, was tie in fire line, you know, to houses that had good defensible space and wineries. But there were homes that it's like, it's going to take us hours to prep this and we don't have the time, but we can put in a little bit of effort on these 3 or 4 homes and save all 3. And
when
so
you
that's
say
where,
tie in fire line, what does that mean?
Tie in fire line is to build fire line. And so in Sonoma and Napa County, you had wineries, and actually the vineyards were great fire breaks. And so we would look at where we could tie in and stop the fire at a vineyard or other types of agricultural fields. And sometimes that was possible, sometimes it wasn't. But certainly in the area we were operating in, that was a something we utilized multiple times.
And tying it in is anchoring it and securing it so it doesn't continue to outflank you and have you have to chase it. Two stories that I heard out of the strike team at the Sonoma County fires at Mike Ron were just indicative of how crazy it can get in these fire sieges. One was, you were sending engines out one at a time, lights and siren off the hill down to the local gas stations to get fuel to come back because they were operating for days on end and were running out of fuel. And normally you get off after 12, 24, 36 hours and you go into a base camp and you get some food and you get some fuel and you get a new assignment. They were sending engines out one at a time to refill because they were running out of fuel. The other one that was an interesting story was when someone from the incident command team made their way out to Mike to do some advanced, you know, recon to see what was going on. He rolled the map out and there was the drawing on the map of where the fire was. And Mike's like, well, actually, keep unrolling the map. We're actually way over here. They were on a fire that the command team still hadn't gotten their arms around to even know was an active fire that had people that had been on it for, what, 3 days already. Mm-hmm. So very dynamic and fluid and, you know, the drought, multiple fires, all these factors make it fantastic storytelling and very, you know.
But it's distance storytelling. You know, when we're talking about this, we're talking about the mechanics of all of this. We're talking about it. We're a little distanced in a sense of I'm looking at both of you right now. And you're human beings that are under a great deal of stress. And I should think there's a lot of fear for your own life as well as those that you care about and you're fighting with. The human aspect of this for you individually, the emotional impact that this job. I mean, when you're unrolling the map, and they're way over there and you're over here, and you have limited engines coming and everything's burning. Let's talk about what it's like for you as people in your work.
So I feel really blessed that I made it through my retirement, because that's actually not a normal thing for a firefighter. Most guys retire on disability. Just the toll that it takes to lift people up and down stairs 3 or 4 times a day, to wear, you know, the equipment, to be sleeping and then, you know, be at a fire or be at a critical medical aid. You know, it takes a toll on a human being. It's just not a natural thing. And there's also a constant stress of just being on, you know, because you never know what the bell is going to ring. You don't know what the bell is going to what's going to happen when the bell goes off, what kind of call. And, you know, you look at Mill Valley or any other community, and it's a beautiful, picturesque community, but there's also a shadow side to that, and that, you know, you see the underbelly of people with severe behavioral health issues, people committing suicide, small children being impacted by, you know, accidents or other types of events. You see the factors of abuse. And it's not just unique to firefighters. Law enforcement certainly sees all of that as well. The aftermath of bar fights, the aftermath of domestic violence, people that aren't able to care for themselves, but, you know, society is, there's no really good way to get them the help they need because, you know, that costs money. So you see, you have to deal with all of that type of stuff.
The pain and suffering.
Yeah.
And that you see mm-hmm. in your job.
So, like Mike, I was very lucky to retire and walk out the door. I had injuries, I had back surgery, various, you know, other ailments that are slowing me down a little bit in life, but I was blessed to be able to walk out because not all of us get to. But something very funny happened within 6 months of retiring, and that is I started crying at movies, and I started allowing myself to be emotionally vulnerable. Because for 38 years, you put that into a box so that you can do the job. And I think I was telling you earlier that more firefighters died from suicide in 2017 than from line of duty death. And we're learning more and more about how to deal throughout our career with the emotional toll that the job takes to be able to process that, but still be able to keep it in the right lane so you can do the job, because it does take its time and you never know when that's going to pop up.
And when that thing that you see
trigger,
that you can't unsee comes percolating
comes
up.
Yeah. 3 months after retirement, I was at a city council meeting follow up on a program that we were getting some closure on. And one of the city council members said, "So how's retirement going?" And I said, "I'll give it to you in one sentence. It might rain tomorrow." And she looked at me and was like, "Huh?" I said, "Well, in retirement, that sentence has a period on the end of it. And if there's a comma, the comma is, and I'm in the middle of a really good book. Or, and I might go for a rain hike. But when you're working, it might rain tomorrow. There's always a comma. And the comma is, oh my gosh, is it an atmospheric river? Is it a king tide? Is it Pineapple Express? Do we have the sandbags out? Do we have generator in the fuel? What's our staffing level? Are we going to open up the command center? Do we have a recall or off-duty personnel? Are we going to activate the cert teams? And did we do a notice on the website? And we're going to, you know, and you are in this constant foot on the gas, emotional, adrenaline, you know, endorphin for 35 years. And even when it's just rain, you're going through that. And when it comes time to take your foot off the gas, you kind of, other stuff happens. Like, I've seen a movie 5 times and I all of a sudden I'm watching it again and I'm crying, going, where's this coming from? I'm allowing myself the ability to do that now, because for all those years, we had to be the non-criers so that we could help the community that was crying. And I say we spend 30 years of our career helping people having the worst 30 minutes of their life.
Yeah, it's probably not suitable for a recording, but Jeff and I saw some horrifying things.
This
you
is
know.
The truth. This is your oral history. And, you can say what you like to say.
Jeff and I, in the early 90s, were on scene of a murder-suicide that was incredibly graphic with disembowelment and a very confusing scene and picture, and that whole response took a toll, you know, on firefighters. Some of them, you know, that needed help for a number of years afterwards. Small kids, you know, having life-ending events that you're in the middle of, and the hard part is we can solve some problems, but there's a lot of problems we can't solve, and so you go back to the station, and it was a bad outcome. You did everything you could, but nevertheless, you know, a family is without their child or their spouse, and you see the community sometimes reaction to that, depending on the nature of the event. So, you know, all that stuff was definitely, you know, it takes a toll. And it's sometimes interesting because you'll go through a really dramatic call. And then the call's over, the ambulance goes to the hospital, you drive back to the station, and there's dinner still waiting to be finished on the table, and you finish your dinner, and you try to push it out of your head so you can be ready for the next call. But certainly, and many times that worked, but there were days where it's like, this isn't working for me, but you push through.
And back in the day, we dealt with it by either not talking about it or by gallows humor. We would make jokes around the table. Not necessarily about that person per se, but just calls that we had been on before or things that were a de-stressor. But that call in particular, you know, I've reflected on that over the years, that I did not do my job as a battalion chief by recognizing the post-traumatic stress potential and engage, because we really didn't have the mechanisms back then to identify it, to be trained to identify it, and then have the resources to do it. And generally you do it after something bad has happened, and then you go out and try to find, you know, how to prevent that from happening again. But
and so you can't be too numb, right, to not deal with it. If you're too numb, you may just shuffle it under. But so you have to keep yourself open enough to understand that you just took a wallop, mm-hmm, and everybody else did, and you're suffering, although you may not know how to handle it when it's, yeah, happening. So you have to be aware enough to have that, but also numb enough to be able to function.
Well, and going back to what I said at the very beginning when I corrected fireman to firefighter, mm-hmm, back then we were firemen, mm-hmm, and we didn't talk about, I'm doing air quotes for the,
yes,
we didn't talk about those kind of things because that was a sign of weakness or vulnerability. So even if you had a struggle with it, it usually manifested with sort of that clandestine behavior, alcoholism.
Right. That's what was going to be my next question. Is there a higher incidence of alcoholism or drug addiction? Or you said physical abuse, mean going home and taking it out on others?
Taking it out on others or, you know, on yourself in an extreme, you know, physical sense, like, you know, climbing to the top of a mountain, you know, when you should have only climbed halfway, or doing some intense, you know, workout to get it out of your system.
Just to beat it out, huh?
I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
That's okay. Interesting.
But I think it's important to note that the fire service has really undergone a cultural change, because back in 1991, when this call occurred, if Jeff had asked me, hey, Mike, I just want to pull together everybody together and do a after action review and de-stressing, you know, we would have all said, no, Chief, we're good. We don't need that. Today, you know, we do that on a regular basis when we face significant calls, and firefighters today are much more vulnerable about it, just because we've slowly, very slowly come to recognize that all that does take a toll on us, and that we need to focus better, more on our behavioral health. I think the health of the fire service has also shifted. When I started, we still had 6 to 8 firefighters out of our organization that smoked. There's only a few people that exercise truly, you know, exercise on a regular basis. And I think I don't want to say it's totally gone away, but I think people self-medicated, you know, to work through it. I think today there's no firefighters in Mill Valley that smoke. The athleticism of your average firefighter, you know, is amazing. You know, and people take better care of themselves, eat better, you know, are more athletically able to do the job.
When the incident you discussed before in our pre-interview chat, you talked about this murder-suicide event, mm-hmm. which what was striking about this particular event, without going too much into the horribly graphic details, is that you didn't know when you walked into this particular event, and maybe you can speak to the confusion that you faced, you weren't sure what was happening or what had happened. It wasn't a clear-cut case of what was going on, so you didn't know if there was somebody potentially nearby that you had to be worried about, or what even had happened.
All those things.
So yeah, maybe you can talk about, just in this particular incident, the brain scramble that occurred for you.
So I was working with another firefighter on the ambulance, and we were called code 2, which is no lights and sirens, to a assault victim. So
this is in Mill Valley.
This is in Mill Valley, actually in Tam Valley. And we jumped in the rig and we're driving there, and a captain about halfway to the call, who I know well and is someone who's always calm under stress, in a very stressed voice, comes over the radio and says, increase the medic unit to code 3. Additionally, start rescue 30 in another engine.
What does that mean, rescue 30?
The
paramedic unit. And so we knew that something was not right. And when we pulled up, he met us at the base of a long driveway and said, step over the first body and help the firefighter with the other person.
And they're inside the house.
They're inside the house. So we walked into the house, and the first body through a knife was mutilated to the point that it was beyond recognition. Something I haven't revealed before is, for a moment, I wondered if it was my girlfriend, you know, because it was a similar body, you know, make, although it was very difficult. Pushed that out of my head, stepped over the first body, and there was blood everywhere, like even on the ceiling, the walls. Yep. And then we came into the second person that had probably 100 stab wounds, was breathing out of a hole in her neck, and she was also disemboweled. And so we started life-saving interventions, there was a sergeant, Sheriff Sergeant, who came up to me and said, so you know this is a suspect. And up until that moment, and I still had a hard time believing it, just because she was so significantly injured, but all of it was self-inflicted. And the sergeant, when he'd walked in the room, had knocked a knife out of her hand. Unfortunately, you know, that day, this woman killed what was a house cleaner who was totally uninvolved in anything. And interestingly enough, this same woman who was the suspect and also we were working to save her life had put poisoned Gatorade bottles in various drugstores around the community, you know, so the law enforcement was already looking for her, but it had not been connected to this incident yet. So that's just one example.
So we didn't really couldn't even comprehend what had happened or put it together. Yeah. And there you are, probably in psychic shock of some kind, just the visuals alone.
Yeah. So the paramedics did some magic. She survived. You know, I'm pretty sure she's still incarcerated this time, you know, and that was an event that was almost 28 years ago.
So you can't unremember that.
No.
There's certain visuals that never go away.
So so do you ever feel tattooed by your work experiences where you're literally, things are embossed in your consciousness forever and you live with that?
There are definitely some. Even on the Sonoma fire siege, you know, mm-hmm. I'm looking at a fire go to, you know, several homes and I go up there with my pickup. I have some hose, you know, garden hose basically with my partner and we're able to save one or two. And I know if I pull other engines off what they're doing right now, those homes are going to burn. So I had to let homes burn to the ground. And I walked up to one house where, you know, you can see there's child's toys all over the place. And I imagine, this could be a firefighter or a friend of mine. There's so much fire, there's nothing that we're going to be able to do to stop it. And so I just checked to make sure there's nobody there, and you walk away from it. And it was just so frustrating not to have resources. And like in the case of the Sonoma fire siege, we didn't get relief until engines from other states showed up. Portland, Oregon, New Mexico, Arizona. You know, those were the engines that finally relieved us on day 4.5, day 5. And yeah, it was just not being able to do anything.
You mentioned in our pre-interview, too, about the difficulty of working in a community that you're so engaged in. Mm-hmm. And you become friends with so many people over time, as we do in our small town.
Yeah.
And then it might be you that's doing CPR on your friend's wife or child or...
CERT volunteer you trained.
Yeah.
That happened to you?
Mm-hmm. And, yeah. So, yeah, no, that's part of being in the community.
Is that a slightly different kind of call for you when you're, I mean, when you go into work mode, I mean, does that make it psychologically that much harder or you just go into work mode and do what you need to do?
Well, I think you always stay in work mode, but it certainly makes it a different call, you know, when it's someone who you know, and that certainly happened multiple times a year. And sometimes these are people that were important in a community or the city, such as a business owner having a heart attack. That's someone who, you know, weeks earlier was, you know, at a big event, you know. And so you definitely have a connection to all those people. And while you stay in focused in work mode, you know, it also, you know, makes it real.
Yeah, there's times where it's like,
you're
it's
putting
like
your
tunnel,
hands up yeah. like
or it's
blinders.
Like a tunnel is closing in on you, or it's like a gust of wind hitting you in the face, or you know, you have that sort of body dilation mm-hmm. where you immediately just go right back to work and you do the job you have to do because you're that duck on the surface that looks calm and underneath or inside your feet are going a million miles an hour, but you're supposed to be that person or those group of people that are bringing that calmness to that moment.
I have to ask you about another story you told me in the pre-interview too about going to a house where you were talking about the difficulty, and this is a good thing to bring into this conversation, of multi-level dwellings. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
So we've lived in hillside structure environments, which is common way to build a house in Marin because we've got steep slopes. And so whether you're in Sausalito, Mill Valley, Larkspur, you know, pretty much every community in Marin has some and some have many like Sausalito and Mill Valley. We had a storm night and we responded out to Tiburon and suppressed a well-involved structure fire. And we came back to the station, showered up, went to bed probably late around, you know, 11 or so at midnight. And probably about an hour later, which is always the toughest when you get calls right after you go to bed, we get toned out for a structure fire in Sausalito. And so you go out to the engine and you put on a very wet, cold turnout coat because you've
just been out
there. It's already soiled. You try to warm it up on your way to the call. And then the adrenaline takes over as you hear the initial dispatch that we've got fire. And so we showed up. Jeff was a battalion chief that night. I was a captain, and I had a four-person crew that night. And we show up to a hillside structure. And when you're looking at your average hillside structure, the house goes below grade from the street. And so we're looking at the garage, and we can see the front door, and there's another engine company that's getting ready to make access through the front door. We start to look at, you know.
And the front door's on which level?
It's
street level.
The street level.
And you're above?
You're on the street level, so you see one garage door and a front door of a house because it's all going
downhill. And it all
downhill.
Goes down, right.
And the interesting thing is this call came in as a fire alarm sounding to Sausalito Engine 1. They got on scene, knocked on the door, and the guy said, "Why are you guys here?" And they could look over the house and see the house was on fire. And they're like, "Sir, your house is on fire." And he had no idea.
Oh, wow.
So there's a crew that's behind the house at this time.
And behind means down slope at the bottom of the hill, looking up at a 3 or 4 story
right.
house.
And you know, we learn from every incident, and during that period of time, a San Francisco engine company went in through a garage door, and the garage door closed behind them, and they were killed.
Uh-huh.
So based on that incident, every garage door that I go through, I'm cutting a 4x8 hole. So
you're not going to depend on the opening and closing.
Yeah, I'm going to make my own opening.
Yeah.
So we were getting ready to apply that strategy, and another engine had just kind of company had just backed out of the front door. Due to they were taking a lot of heat, the entire house falls away from us.
So wait, let's just be clear now. You have to be careful about, because I remember from the classes I took in the fire department about how heat and smoke moves.
Right.
And so when you've got a tri-level or four-level house, and you open up a window in the top, and there's a fire down below.
Right, or a door,
which
is the most common. So back then, we would go through the front door. We'd open up the front door every day of the week, which is opening the top of the chimney.
Right, uh-huh. Sticking your head down the chimney and seeing what's burning.
Yes, creating an increased flow of oxygen. So,
and so that would now be the new flow path of the fire.
And so you have to be careful about that.
Well, we do, and it. But the awareness of that really didn't occur till two San Francisco firefighters went through the front door of a house and were killed in the flow path of fire that rapidly changed once they opened the front door and left it open to where they had come in.
It just was a shoot of fire that came up. And
so as a fire service, not just in locally but across California, everybody really looked at that. And then we realized how many near misses we had had from similar type events. So we don't fight fire that way anymore. You know, today on a hillside structure, which are always difficult because you have to understand that on your average house in Mill Valley, you might end up almost needing to rappel on a rope to access the sides of it and get to the back, that your only easy access is the front. So you're kind of sometimes almost steered to go through that front door, but you can't.
You can't.
And so you need to go down to the same level as the fire or even below it and attack it from there. You know, so that's one of the little evolutions that we've done in smart strategies.
Back to the house in Sausalito. So the crew had been, there'd been a crew down below.
And they saw how bad it was from the back, that we could not see it from the front.
So they backed out.
So they ran for their lives because they saw it was about to fall.
They saw the house was about to fall from the fire, or was there a slide
from going? The fire?
The fire.
And so then you guys are up there about to make your opening, and you go to make your opening, and the house falls.
Right. And when I say fall, there's cars in the garage. And the whole house just peels 30 or 40 or 50 feet away from us down the hill in a big, huge.
This is right after two firefighters, as we were arriving, were backing out from the stairway with a hose line saying, we're not making enough progress. We're going to need to reposition. And Mike's getting ready to make the cut. And
suddenly
it was
you're cutting into
fractions
air.
Of seconds. And
yes.
And you're cutting it. You've got your
the saw started.
Saw going, ear hole, and you literally watch the house just disappear and you've got air in front of you.
And the interesting thing is, you know, the house could have been built either way. The driveway was not attached to the house. And so we're standing on the driveway, and the pad remains there as the house falls away. And other days, it could have taken the entire pad and us with it.
Yep. And then as the house crumbles, you've got your men below, and you don't know what's happened to them then.
Right. So there's radio silence, and there's numerous calls to them, which they can't answer because they're trying to still get out of the way and regain their composure. But I think for a minute and a half, I was convinced that engine company was dead. Until they popped up on the street.
Yep. So how do you manage your, I mean, that's rather shocking. I mean, you've got, how do you manage your feelings after that?
Then you go back to your checklists and you say, okay, accountability, engine 7, is everybody here? Engine 1, is everybody here? Who's not here? And you just start to chunk your problem up and attack it systematically. And you go back to those systems that you use. And that's what gets you through that moment.
I remember one of the fire chiefs when I was working at the fire department saying that you practice something so much that you don't have to think about it. And that's what can save you when there's a calamity going on where you don't, it's not your emotion going through and incorrectly or whatever it's doing in a panic,
right,
making decisions, but the protocol that you've trained again and again and again is what saves you, and that's what you depend on in working with each other.
And we try to let rookies and people in fire academies know you're training not only to get it right, but when it matters, to not get it wrong.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
So I want to shift gears and tell another story that we didn't get a chance to tell you, but it's all sort of coming together in how do you deal with the unknowns and, you know, how do you deal with stuff that sort of is outside the norm? But it's a bit of a funny story, too, but there's...
Well, we could use a little levity here.
So we were buying the GPS units for the engines, the Garmin, you know, that everybody has in their car, which is now in the smartphone. But we had had them in the battalion chief's vehicles, and a couple guys had gotten them at home. And then we bought them and put them in the fire engines. And that day, the captain says to me, so what if I put in an address and it's telling me to go all the way over there? And I know I can, and he's like pointing at a part of the hill. He goes, and I know I can go that way. What do I do? And I said, well, this is an adjunct. This supports you. But if you know a better way, use it. But this is an additional tool, just like the run book or whatever it may be. So this is here to help you. It's not here to tell you and run your life. It's a tool. So a couple days later, we get dispatched again to a fire in Sausalito, and it's 11, 12 o'clock at night, Christmas Eve. And the fire is in an area where there's a dead zone in the radio system.
Oh, yeah.
So Mike is being dispatched on the initial response. They immediately upgrade it, so I get assigned as the second battalion chief. The fire's down in a pocket down here in Sausalito, and we can't hear the battalion chief saying, we have an access problem and a water problem. I need all the engines to come around the bottom.
Actually, I did hear that.
You did hear that, but you might have been committed already.
Right.
So we had plugged it into the Garmin, and it's saying go up the freeway and then come down Spencer when he was telling everybody to come in from the bottom. So the engines that followed that came in from the bottom and all got stuck at the bottom because of a bottleneck. And we're driving along. Nothing's on the radio. We can hear nothing. And I don't know what was going through your head, but I'm behind Mike in my pickup going, I really screwed up. I'm listening to this GPS unit and I don't hear anything on the radio.
Right.
And all of a sudden we come around a corner and the radios come back on and they've got a second degree burn victim or third degree burn victim that's jumped out the window. The cop is walking them up the hill, put them in the fire engine. The firefighter immediately starts to treat them. I back my truck up because there's a fire hydrant right there. Mike or his crew connects to the hydrant and I pull the hose off and we put first water on the fire from the top of the hill. So we're all lamenting the technology isn't going to do the right thing. And it told us to go the wrong way to be in the exact right place at the right time. And we treated the burn victim. We had water on the fire from a different water source. And we put first water on the fire. And sometimes
that was a good day.
That was a good day.
Yeah. It was one of those days where you come back and it was like, I can't believe that happened.
So we've talked about a lot of hard days.
We were brilliant. It's like, how did you know to go that way?
Yeah. It could have worked differently, as arbitrary it is. But there must be a lot of good days. Any babies delivered?
I got to observe and be in the room this big when it happened, but the paramedics were taking care of it. But yes, I got to be in a room and observe a home delivery. I was actually the first responder on scene with the paramedics about 20 seconds behind me. But it's a rare occurrence in our careers, but it's one of those magical moments when it does happen. And those are the calls that you remember for your whole life.
How many rescued people come to the station with banana bread and a hug to say thanks?
Quite a few.
Yeah, people are really grateful oftentimes, and certainly we've gotten a lot of that. And I think we've painted a picture of the shadow side of it, but it's incredibly rewarding to, have somebody who's in a diabetic emergency and see the paramedics administer glucose and see them come, to be conscious again, to see people that are in cardiac arrest that have been resuscitated or people that have undergone, severe traumatic injuries and come back, 4 to 6 months later and bring you, cookies or a carton of ice cream and say, how thank you they are. And there is a lot of great healing, from people that have had heart attacks to strokes to traumatic injuries that you can tell that you made a really big difference in their lives.
And we've had occasions where we've had a pediatric call, whether we saw it as life-threatening or seconds count or just a routine call where we're doing our job, but the impact on the family, and the family will come by every year on the anniversary of that call or on their child's birthday to, help us blow the candles out on the cake or to be there for another photo. And so there are those incredibly rewarding moments, and it doesn't always happen, but it does sometimes seems to happen when you need it the most, when you've had a bad day for whatever reason and someone knocks on the door with a plate of cookies and, you guys came and helped me the other day. And then, of course, the mischievous side of the fire department kicks in because then, oh, thank you very much. And then as soon as they leave, you look up the call and if it was another shift, you make sure to eat all the cookies and leave them just a couple of crumbs. You never want to leave the cookies,
good to know.
Yeah.
Or you eat all the ice cream except one scoop at the bottom or something.
The other rewarding thing of the fire service is just working with such amazing people. Your colleagues in the fire service, your shift, and you're not close to everybody, but everybody works really well together because we have to. But there are many people that I was, will be lifelong friends that went through and undergone, did a lot of stuff together. And just the seeing how professional people are, and the overcoming significant challenges together, whether it be a structure fire or a rescue or a critical medical aid, there's a lot of reward afterwards of successful outcomes. And when I look at my fire service career, and if I wanted to do anything different, even though there, it's had its challenges, I can't imagine doing, having done anything else. And I'm really proud of, my career and what I got to do.
Let's have, there must be pivotal individuals that have influenced your life or been heroes to you or mentors. Do you have any names that you'd like to share?
Sure. There was a gentleman in Mill Valley, when I started here, named John Keane, and he ended up leaving Mill Valley as a battalion chief and going to work up in Valley of the Moon up in Sonoma County. But he was very instrumental in mentoring and supporting me as one of the young guys on the cusp of the department's changing and professionalizing and formal education. And another gentleman outside the department who was huge in my career and very sadly passed away unexpectedly last year, a gentleman named Tom Forrester. And if you're interested in looking at marinefirehistory.com, I think it is, all the work you see on that website of the history of the Marin County Fire Services is all Tom. And I can probably say I'm one of 500 people that can say that he was a huge friend and mentor and had huge impact in my life. And from day one, when I interacted with him, he was open and accessible and willing to train and educate me and share his knowledge with me. And he got me outside of my fire department, and it wasn't just about what Mill Valley's doing, but how can Mill Valley work better with Tiburon and with Corte Madera and with Petaluma and Santa Rosa and collaborate. And he was really big about, you know, the relationships and working collaboratively. Huge, huge impact. And then some other people, I would say Ken Mazzucco, who is retired fire chief from Marin County Fire Department. I think if Ken had one fault, is he saw us as his family. But that was also one of the good things about Ken. And sometimes he, you know, held on a little too tight. But he treated me like I was a member of his fire department, even though I wasn't with the Marin County Fire Department. He was there hands down, you know, without question. And he and a couple of other people at Marin County Fire Department have been huge, huge mentors in my life. I would also say that I would vacillate between calling Mike a role model and a mentor for me, because any of the success that I had in my 20 plus years as a battalion chief occurred with you being on the shift the majority of the time and experiencing a lot of good, bad, and ugly together, and getting through that together and seeing how he collaborated with community and brought volunteer groups together and challenged for training and professionalism only made me better. So this guy sitting right next to me has been a huge influence in my career.
Well, thank you, Jeff. I would start off at the very beginning with like Bob Mariani at Kent Field, who is kind of a legendary Marine Fire Service figure. Even chiefs from other agencies like Rit Hewitt, San Rafael, I worked with on the hazmat team, and Mike Angeli. And then going to Marin County Fire, Doug Cole and Ken Mazzucco, you know, were certainly also major mentors for me. And I certainly evolved. You know, Jeff Davidson was a huge mentor of me, and he and I will talk in the sound booth of each other, but we didn't always have good days. And there were days where I certainly got called out, you know, for things that I wasn't doing right, justifiably so. And so, you know, all that made me a better firefighter.
And it was a two-way street, because Mike and I could speak truth to each other. Mm-hmm. And it was hard truth sometimes, but it was truth that needed to be spoken, and it made us better and stronger, and it was better for the organization. Yeah. Absolutely.
Captains like Jim McClure, Steve Kampf, Greg Moore, both as a captain, one of my first captains, and a battalion chief, you know, was someone who I learned a lot from. Jim Ray, I learned a tremendous amount from, just an excellent fire ground officer. I fondly call him, you know, my mentor, but also sometimes my tormentor. You know, and there's also, I was influenced by a lot of firefighters that work for me as well, certainly. So many that I couldn't even begin to name them.
I remember in the EMT class I took, the teacher said, trauma brings people together. Mm-hmm. And once I started hanging around the firehouses, I realized that there were unique and beautiful relationships that had been literally forged by fire between the people that worked together, that there was a community of individuals working together that had not only, as you described, a communication in which you were honest, you were able to be honest with each other and share, but also a sort of psychic connection. Mm-hmm. Because there are many times where words just don't do it. You're wearing masks. There's smoke between you, that you have to know each other so well that you can anticipate that person's decision-making and their actions. And I think that is what, that kind of relationship is what strengthens the fire department.
So yesterday I was at the Fire Academy in Santa Rosa, and one of the instructors that's up there is with Foster City now, but he was previously with the Larkspur Fire Department. And in 1995, we were at a fire up in Lake County for a week, and we see each other twice a semester, but it's almost like your taste buds come alive when you see each other because you're right back in that moment. And that forging is never going to go away. And we just immediately go into the shtick about, you know, oh, the vortex from hell and, you know, and the fork fire. And we go right into our, you know, sort of comic routine or something. But we go right back into it and we'll never lose that connection.
When we're talking about Mill Valley and we're thinking about our concerns here today in a changing environment and with all this development and trees that haven't had any fire reduction, the materials there waiting to burn, and we're able to see and smell, as happened in the fires recently with Paradise when there was so much smoke and before that, we may not be in the flame, but we're close enough to feel the devil's breath on our neck. And for some of us, maybe there's a more intimate, like for me, I lost my identical twin sister as a result of the Sonoma fire. She didn't burn, but she had a heart attack while evacuating. So it's not the consequence for the care we need to take of our own home and our community isn't just about the houses that we can lose, but it's the people that are killed, the way our lives are changed, and the people that die as a result of the whole process, you know, the secondary deaths, like with my sister. There's so much to consider and so much at stake. And I remember asking the fire captain in San Anselmo, what do you do in case of a true calamity? Where do you begin? And he said, and these words I've lived by, he says, you start where you stand. Well, we're standing here in Mill Valley, and I'm going to ask you gentlemen to help us help you. What can we as a community, what in Mill Valley can we do better to help ourselves as well?
So going back to there's only 7 or 8 firefighters and 3 police officers and 14,000 people, mm-hmm. you know, the realization that you're not probably going to be the priority during a disaster. So it goes to the heart of personal responsibility, which means having enough provisions and supplies to take care of yourself and your family. You know, for more than several days, we learned at Katrina that 3 days is not enough. Probably need 5 to 7, and that may not be enough in a major disaster. So be ready. Take CERT training. You know how to turn off your gas. Know how to do some basic first aid and light search and rescue. And you know, if you have car camping supplies, you know, all that stuff works. You know, during a major disaster, because you may not feel comfortable going back inside your home and sleeping there. Don't expect the local government, the city of Mill Valley, to be able to take care of you, because we're not going to be able to. And our priorities going to be life first, you know, property second, and everything else third. And so we're going to triage to what we can do, you know, the most good for the most people.
And now this is my segue into what's happening in the future. We've got some changes going on in the town as to the fire prevention. Mm-hmm. Before we close this interview, let's talk about that a little bit.
Sure. And before we get to that, my answer to that question is everything that Mike said, but with the sort of exacerbation on it. But we've been saying this for years.
How frustrating.
And where I feel like I'm sort of emotionally just at a dead end with, why is it not sticking? How do we get that message out? And how do we move the needle past? Because everything that we're saying is not brand new, hot off the press. It's the same book reprinted year after year after year. And I don't know how we get the community to engage. I know that we did the 5th grade Get Ready, and that's going to have a huge impact. But mm-hmm. that's a long-term thing. How do we get people to, you know, take that responsibility in the moment? And I think it's not just a emergency earthquake fire problem in Mill Valley. I think it's a societal mm-hmm. problem. There's an expectation that someone else will fix or solve the problem, but I'm not held to any standard because someone else should do it. And I don't know how we get past that. And
well, let's try to blast that delusion anyway. But perhaps it's time to bring back the fireman's brawl. and use it as an opportunity. The Historical Society's been thinking about
brawl.
That.
Oh, boy.
So. I think the fireman's ball. We don't want a brawl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, moving forward, in the last 3 years, we've seen more destructive fires more frequently than any other time in, you know, history. And so, as a community in Mill Valley, where we already know we are a fire-prone community that could experience a significant fire loss, we need to do more. And so, starting right away, people need to be much more aggressive on their vegetation management. The codes that the city is looking at enforcing is having no vegetation within 3 feet of your house, and this includes wood chips. Because we learned through the recent firestorms that what's igniting houses is the stuff that's directly adjacent to the house, oftentimes stuff we planted. And if you go back to the 1970s during the drought, you know, we encourage people to plant evergreens like juniper and cypress and bamboo and things like that because it requires very little water. What's been happening, and we noticed this during the Oakland firestorm, is that that juniper that you planted in front of your house is what burns your house down. And so Mill Valley is considering an ordinance that's going to outlaw bamboo, juniper, cypress, and acacia, and also outlaw having any vegetation unless they're irrigated succulents next to your structure. And I think these are good first steps. The other thing we're going to do is we're going to be much more aggressive about enforcing existing code. We send firefighters into the hills each year to do inspections, but oftentimes they're called away on medical aid calls or other things, so it's hard to have that continuity. We're going to have focused people doing inspections, and we're going to write stuff we probably haven't written before because, you know, we only had the bandwidth to do so much. But as a community, if you like your privacy screen, which is bamboo, we're going to ask you to reconsider that. And you're probably going to be able to see your neighbors a lot more. But the reality is the ornamental vegetation that we're planting as privacy screens or because we like living in a dense forest is what's going to burn our community down.
Mm-hmm. And so I can just anticipate how this is going to go over.
No, it's interesting, and people are conflicted because I'll have somebody saying, boy, I love everything we're doing, and I go out to their house and I point out what's actually going to look like. And they're very concerned. It's like, well, no, I like that bush, or I like that bamboo screen because I don't want to see that neighbor. And I'm like, well, that's what has to go. So I think people are encouraged to see it up until the moment they actually see what it looks like. And the reality is that Mill Valley's never had this much vegetation in it. If you go to the Mill Valley History Room mm-hmm. and you look at some of the old photos on the walls, it's Middle Ridge's grasslands, yep. mm-hmm. you know, and now it's a big timber forest with thousands of homes on it. And so we have to do something very different.
Yes. Your life depends on it and your property. Mm-hmm. Something we haven't talked about and I'd like to include briefly is women in the fire department.
Not enough. We need more.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Has having women in the fire department changed the emotional, option when it comes to, I mean, you guys, maybe do women handle the fallout after some kind of serious event differently than men? Does it?
They can. But I think at the same time, we're becoming a more diverse workforce. We're also bringing in the tools for the existing workforce to be more accessible to dealing with the PTSD stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I just think a more diverse workforce that reflects your community allows you to engage the community at levels that a bunch of white males may not be able to. Mm-hmm. So I think diversity is hugely important. And, you know, if we all come from the same emotional box, we're all going to see the problem the same way. And to be able to have a broad breadth and depth of people looking at problems and situations and creating bridges to solutions. You know, Mike might be really good at telling somebody tactically what their neighborhood should look like from a firefighting standpoint, whereas an inspector might have a psychological background or a sociology degree and be able to talk to them on a more empathetic level. Not to say that Mike can't or doesn't, but it's just bringing more people with different approaches in is a good thing. And diversity is, I think, a huge part of that.
And we have several female firefighters that work in the Southern Marin area. One of them is Yvette Blount. She's every bit as capable as a male firefighter. But one of the things that I've seen over and over again is she's much better able to connect with a patient, whether it be male or female or a kid, than a male, by her nature, you know. And it's not unique to her. I've seen some male firemen have that charm offensive that is great with connecting with old people. So I think everybody, you know, has their gifts, and some of it is strength, but the fire service is not driven on strength alone, and being able to connect with our community, being able to connect with our patients, and being able to have the technical skills to work up a critical call, you know, that's not about strength, you know, that, and that's about a lot of other types of skills. So, you know, I think the fire service in this area would benefit from having more females.
Is there anything we haven't talked about that you would like to say before we close?
It's just been an interesting experience to talk about, you know, the whole spectrum of topics that we've talked about, because I don't think I've processed some of this stuff fully until today, and I appreciate the opportunity.
And I guess I just keep going back to, the community. I want them to continue to understand that we are the tool to be used after the problems occurred. And we need their help to design the problem so it doesn't require so many of us. And again, that's that engagement piece and moving the needle slowly over time. But we may run out of time. We may not have enough time. So whatever we can do to get the community to take personal responsibility and buy into this problem with us will just make it that much easier for the next generation and generations of firefighters and public safety employees in this community.
Well, I think we've captured a lot in this interview.
Feels like it, yeah.
I want to thank both of you for your long service, for all that you've given of yourselves, of your bodies, of your psychology, of your time in service to us as the community, for the wisdom that you've gained over time that you've shared with me today. I really can't tell you how much it means to me personally and to everybody, whether they know it or not, that lives in this town and beyond. I've enjoyed being updated to how things are changing and the tendrils that have gone out as gentle, fragile ones that have strengthened as we become a more cohesive unit overall. I find it remarkably comforting to know that your affiliation with all these different units and different companies is overall strengthening the entire process of firefighting. So it's incredibly gratifying to understand exactly what's been going on. I just want to say thank you on behalf of Mill Valley Historical Society and the library, but the community that doesn't know this yet, but will learn it hopefully when they hear this interview, for all that you've both done.
Well, thank you.
So long.
And for doing the work to capture not just the interview today, but the work that the Historical Society does in general. It's a gem that this community probably doesn't fully comprehend and tap into to understand the history of this community and the people that have come before us.
Well, we try what we can try.
Yeah, exactly.
And reach where we can reach, and we can keep on trying and keep on reaching.
Yeah.
So thank you both very much.
Yeah.
I think that concludes our interview on behalf of the Historical Society and the library. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.